Good. We'll call the meeting to order for BCHA meeting September 9, 1990. We have much to be thankful for today, so I think it would be appropriate if we would all stand and do the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Now I'll be seated. Well, did you get enough to eat? If not, we'll do a little bit more later. All right. Now, can you hear me back there all right? Tommy, can you hear me back there? Fine, good. I see a few more people coming, so we'll wait just a moment till they come in. But I do want to thank Oliver and Sue Reinhart today for all of this nice hall and all the things that they did, and those who helped them. Oliver, Sue, and I know we have visitors here today, so I'd like for the visitors to stand. I know we have some from Niederensen, Oberensen, Bernie, Luke, and Lucienne, Ryan, and then Dr. Frisch. Where are you from again?
San Luis.
San Luis, okay. Glad to have you here. Then, do we have other visitors? Mrs. Wicks? Yes, 7 weeks, right? 7 weeks? Aye, that's great. Let's give her a... Not her, you. They've been married. Now, we have other visitors. Yes? Sally Brooks, so nice to have you here. And I know we have some new members that are here for the first time. Will you stand and let us see who you are? Oh, Central? Oh, glad you're here. Any other members, new members? Great, great. Would you stand? Let us welcome you. This is Johnny Bartschild from Houston. And I know who that is back there that just came in. How are you? We're so glad that all of you are here today, and we have a lot of things planned for you today. So sit back, relax, and I'm going to ask Bertha if she would introduce our speaker for the day. We're going to take things a little out of order, so don't worry. While Bertha is coming up, I want to tell you about the carving over here. I want you to later on look at it if you haven't. Whitey brought that, well, Stensmeyer brought that in today. It was given to the Jehennas from their sister cities, Niederensen, Oberensen, last fall when the group came over for the big celebration and party that we had out here. So take a look at it after a while, and it's a beautiful piece of handwork. Bertha? We're very pleased and honored today to have with us Dr. Scott Baird, who is an English professor at Trinity University. He has been there since 1974, English and linguistics he specializes in, and I could tell you a whole lot about him, but I'm just going to
not say too much and let him do the talking. He has lived in Japan where he studied, worked with linguistics there, and that's what his real interest, I guess, and hobby and all is with linguistics. He's come to our cemetery, the old one, several times already. He's been to the Castroville Cemetery, and he is going to tell us today just what he has learned by studying their wording, I guess, on their tombstones and what it means to us, or what it can mean. I'll get Dr. Scott Beard from Trinity University. I forgot to introduce his wife, Renee. Would you stand up, Renee? We're glad to have her.
Last spring, when I was first contacted about speaking with you, I was working on it's my electromagnetic personality. I was working on an idea that was suggested to me at a conference of the American Name Society in D.C. last December. I had given a paper on the evolution of names as I had seen them in the cemeteries. And a woman who is a specialist in genealogy took offense at one of the comments I had made, and that was that within one plot in City Cemetery number 1 in San Antonio, I had seen the Ruth family, W. Umlaut, S-T-E, Riste, that behind that, the family name had been changed to Rust without the umlaut, and then behind that, it was W-U-E-S-T, and off to the side, it was W-E-S-T. Now, I had seen that same change of names within family plots, had never seriously studied it. In fact, I was trying to remember on the way down here, and I did not have my slides with me. There was a French family also in City Cemetery number 1 that was the Friere family with the accent and two R's. And then next to it, the accent disappeared. The third one in the same plot, the second R disappeared, and the last time it was just F-R-I-E-R, Friar. And but I did have my slides with me in D.C., and I showed it to this woman later, and she has corresponded 2 or 3 times telling me that I had totally destroyed the basic assumption among genealogists, the basic assumption being that family names changed because people moved away. We were a mobile society. People were moving and they forgot how to spell names. So when I received the phone call last spring, I thought I would become an instant 3-month expert in genealogy and talk to you all about what I have discovered. And discovered I do not want to fool around with the expert work that genealogists do. I will let that woman take the idea and go with it. What I would rather do is talk to you about what I think is important about the Castro colony Heritage Association and similar associations as I see them appearing, some of them brand new, some of them growing around Texas. And I will start that by telling you a story that happened to me only yesterday. I was at a conference at University of Texas in San Antonio yesterday morning, met a person whose name was Leon Petropoli, who is a retired chemical engineer who still speaks like he was on a boat that came over 2 days ago, and has been here about, I think he told me, 45 years. And he walked up to me during the first break and said, "Oh, you teach technical writing. I was really interested." I said, "Thank you. Your name is Petropoli. That excites me. What nationality is it?" And as we were talking, it turns out it's Bulgarian, and it's not Polish, it's not, and I said, "I know, that's why I don't want to make a guess on a name like that, because from the outside, they all look the same. But on the inside, there's major differences." As we were talking, an older friend that I met 3 years ago walked up, listened to the last part of the conversation, and said, "I don't know why you're wasting this time. We're all Americans, just Americans." His name happens to be Tom Brand. Well, if your name is Tom Brand, you can say, "We're all Americans, we're just Americans." My name is Scott Baird, B-A-I-R-D. I'm just an American too. I can get by with that. I would like to talk to you today about why we can be just American. Nothing made me feel better when I walked in this room, secondarily to being accepted and wanted when I walked into this room, than the American flags on the table. And just before I was introduced, we pledged allegiance to the American flag. So what does it mean if we're just Americans? And what I would like to do is to talk a little bit about that. Let me begin with, what does it mean to be a French Texan? Let's start with that. Do you consider yourself French Texans here in this room? I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that you are advertised in the newspapers, the Folklife Festival, every time there's something new going on with the Sisters of the Providence, and then the Alsatian French in Texas. So on the outside, the Alsatian community, the Castro Colony's heritage, it comes across as a French Texas heritage. So how do you fit in with other French Texans? I need to start off by saying the first French people in the Americas were way up near Nova Scotia in Acadia in 1603. And when the British and the French were fighting over the Americas, the North Americas, those poor Acadians, as they were called, got pushed back and forth in all of the fighting. In 1685, another group of Frenchmen settled in now what is called Nacogdoches. It's interesting that the Spanish also put a fort up there within 20 years, and they spelled the town differently, but you have the French on one side and the Spanish on the other side in this tug of war on the southern part of North America. Would it be French or would it be Spanish? So the French were involved with the English up in the northern part, and they were involved with the Spanish here on the southern part, the Gulf part of the Americas. In 1713, Acadia became English. And then in 1755, the British were beginning to get worried about the French, so they deported Acadians. As a kid growing up in Kansas, I learned about this deportation through a poem called Evangeline by Longfellow. I remember reading that, but I didn't realize that there were Acadians, and I just thought this beautiful woman getting, oh my goodness. And why, I didn't understand it, but it was kind of interesting and very romantic and so on. What happened is large numbers of those Acadians went, of course, down the Mississippi to the New Orleans area where the French had been there, a different group of French, but they were better than those British up there in Nova Scotia. In 1803, after this, there was the Louisiana Purchase. The United States said, all right, we are going to get all of that territory. It's not going to be French, it's not going to be Spanish, it's going to be just America. And so you have this funny mixture in East Texas then of two groups of French. The Acadians, who had come down a long history, had come down from Acadia, from Canada, and then some Napoleon, what was the word? They have their own word for it, if I can find it here. I can't find it. Napoleonic exiles were the ones that settled that fort area in Nacogdoches. Then, about the time you had these two groups of French more or less getting along, another group came down to the Galveston Island. Those were the ones who maybe, maybe not settled in South Texas, but joined Jean Lafitte back on the island of Galveston, and that's a third group of French who were here. Then Texas became independent. Now you have to pardon me for not being a true Texan at this point. My distance, being born and raised in Kansas, allows me to look at the ethnic movement into the Republic of Texas with total fascination. I am convinced that in that 10 or 11 year period, from 1839 to 1849, when Texas was a republic, I am convinced that the Czechs thought they would take over Texas. Now remember, Texas then went all the way up to Montana. It included Colorado, New Mexico, parts of New Mexico. But I'm convinced that the Czechs thought for sure they were going to have a little Czechoslovakia over here. I'm sure the Germans felt the same way. I'm sure the Polish, the Czechs, the Italians. If you look at all of the tremendous movement of all of these ethnic groups, including our famous Henry Castro, who came here when this was a republic. It was not part of Mexico. It was not part of the United States. Why did he come here? Was it because he believed in the Republic of Texas or the Republic of Texas / France? I don't know, but I have a strong feeling that if one were to go back and read the inside writings back in Europe, not what transpired here, but all of these land companies, the German land companies, the French land companies, the Italian land companies, that what they really thought was that possibly we can establish our own colony over here and call it Texas. Be that as it may, it didn't work out that way. Texas joined the Union, meaning the Union of States, became part of the United States. They almost immediately sold off big hunks of Texas, the Montana, Colorado, New Mexico hunk, and gave it to the United States, became much smaller, a state, then joined the Union, with some of them going to the Union side, some going to the Confederate side during the war, and Texas, that we know it here, those of you who were born and raised here in Tejanas, and those of us who came down today from San Antonio for the first time, we are Americans, and we look at that as our world that we're looking at today, as opposed to this historical, maybe it was going to be a little France, maybe it was not. Texas joined the Union, a fifth group of French people came over here. These were the socialist intellectuals that settled in Dallas. And when I talk to people north of, say, Waco, and talk about the French people in Texas, they don't think of the Cajuns so much. They don't think of the Alsatians here in this section so much, nor the Galveston, nor the Nacogdoches. They think of this group of very, very ideological socialists, these intellectuals that came over from France, settled in a town called, I think it was La Reunion, near Dallas. It lasted 1855, 1857, and I think the intellectuals decided they'd rather get rich than be famous in their own little colony. So they moved to Dallas and became very much a part of the central power in Dallas today, the business power. So you talk to French influence up there. All right, let me back up. What does it mean to be just American? For those of you who are here with the Castro Colonies Heritage Association, you have an image of America that I don't think varies the slightest from mine, having grown up in Kansas. I think that is just America. But you do have a different set of roots. You have a different heritage. And that's what I guess excites me more about the work that I do than anything else. Texas, I'm going to tell you something you've never heard before. Texas is different. Texas is the only southern state, that has a huge immigration population. I'm now going to put the French Texan together with the German Texan, with the Czech Texans, the Chinese Texans. As an aside, the oldest Chinese community in the United States is in El Paso. The second oldest Chinese community in the United States is in San Antonio. Part of what I love about Texas is most Texans didn't know that. They just said, well, they've always been there, so who cares? And I don't mean that in a bad sense. We've always had those Chinese here. Yes, you have. Longer than anywhere else in the United States. let alone in the South. Basically, in the United States, the largest number of us just Americans can trace our ancestry back to the Scotch-Irish. We are the biggest plurality. The biggest number of Americans today can trace their ancestry back to the Scotch-Irish. I don't have time to go into that, but that is double-edged. To me, being Baird, that's as Scotch as it can be. And that ancestry means I am mainstream America. Very briefly, the Scotch-Irish slice mixture are the most bigoted, warlike bunch of rednecks I've ever heard of in the history of the world. And when you talk about mainstream America, that's what we're talking about. And it's embarrassing now that I know that my name is Baird. Alright? The second largest number of immigrant heritage in the United States is German. Now think of the second biggest bunch of bigot rednecks in the whole world you can think of, and we're talking about mainstream America, and it is embarrassing if that's all we saw. The largest number of people who moved across the United States, the pioneers, were Scotch-Irish. And in the northern part of the United States, the Germans were right behind them. Yes, the British came in, but the British basically came in, stuck around Boston or around Charleston. They didn't move west. That's the third largest group, by the way, the English. When you talk about mainstream America, we're talking Scotch-Irish number one, German number two, and the English number three. The English settled along the coast of the United States. When the Hungarians, the Polish, the Prussians, the French, the Huguenots, the Dutch came to the United States, the Italian, they came in and traveled along the northern part of the United States. In the South, you have in the mountains the Scotch-Irish. The Scotch-Irish brought us, among other things, country western music and bourbon whiskey. All right, that's part of the culture that what we call the Highlands or the Mountain Southern dialect had. Along the coast, you have the British and you have the blacks. And that's the speech that we discover along the South. And any of you from the South, realize that there's two different dialects there. And the more we study these, the more we realize that in the mountains with that Highlands Southern speech, we have a different Scotch-Irish influence than along the coast, including the Gulf Coast, Atlantic Coast. That's where the Southerners settled, with one big exception, New Orleans with the French. But what is the second largest immigrant group in New Orleans? Anybody here know? Irish. Right. You want to hear the Brooklyn accent, you talk to Simone Donahue, who is from New Orleans and sounds like she's from Brooklyn. All right. She's just that Scotch-Irish background. Texas has, in the along the Dallas area, basically Highlands Southern speech. The mountain people came out of Arkansas, the Ozarks, that's where the Scotch-Irish came, and they came down into the Dallas-Fort Worth area as illegal immigrants when Texas belonged to Mexico, and when Texas was a republic. When Castro came here, there were large numbers of Scotch-Irish. You can find them proudly waving their flags north up here in Mason, but they were down here too. They were illegal. They didn't care about laws. They just went where nobody else was. And you know how the Hatfields and the McCoys get along? That's how the Scotch-Irish get along with everybody. All right? They didn't care about Mexican laws. They didn't care about Texas laws. They didn't care about U.S. laws. I'm going where the land is. Get out of the way. I'm going further west. All right? Along the eastern part of the United States, of Texas, you have the lowlands southern speech. So basically Houston and north, you have the lowlands southern and you have the highlands southern up around Dallas. While all of that's going on, we have to realize that the Spanish were doing a much better job of colonizing the United States, colonizing America than the North Americans were doing. As a result, when Henry Castro came here, there were large numbers of Spanish-speaking people all over this territory. There were large numbers of people speaking two dialects of Southern English, and what we call Mexican Spanish was being spoken here at a time when the French were trying to establish their own colony. Right. The result is, and I will finish up on this now, what I see in the cemeteries around here is that in St. Louis Cemetery, roughly 2,000 markers. I'm not breaking that down. A marker can be shared, husband and wife, or it can be single. Right, or it can be shared with the whole family. You all know all these. But just look around. We counted, meaning me and three of the students, have counted about 2,000 markers in St. Louis Cemetery in Castroville. Only four of those are in French. Two of the four are the wife of Henry Castro and his daughter-in-law, and they're undecipherable. You can't read it. You just know every now and then by looking at it that there's a little bit of French there. So the whole cemetery, we only found four French language markers. 60%, about 1,200, are in German. Mixtures of German and English and German. In the northern section, about 10%, between 150 and 200 are in Spanish. And the other 30% are in English. Of those English, the following names, Beaupark, Fabie, Leconte, Bourgeois, definitely are French, but they're in English. And they go clear back, the early deaths, those families go back to the 1850s. So immediately when the French were here, with the French family names, they were writing in English. If you look at the German stones, they have Ludwig Weber Haas. Ludwig Weber Haas, Ludwig Weber Haas, all over the place, that were in German. And they did not give up their German native language as quickly as the French family names did. In Zion Lutheran Church, I'm assuming that St. Louis is basically Catholic, but that's just an assumption that could easily be proven or disproven. Zion Lutheran Church is only 50 or 60 markers. They're almost all German. I assume, of course, that we have the handful of Protestants. But everyone, Beaupark, I don't know how to say those words, and Haby, are also in English, even in the Lutheran cemetery. The French names are in English. So what does all this mean? I'm going to close up right now. To be just American, I think, means two things. The first thing it means is that we are strong when we are the most diverse. I think the best example I can give, analogy, is that stupid one of using a sports analogy. On a football team, if everybody is the quarterback, you're going to be killed by the opposing team, because they have guards and tackles and centers and linebackers. I mean, they're going to cremate you if all you've got is quarterbacks. Okay, change it. All you have are tackles. All right, you're still going to be cremated. All right, you've got to have that diversity. Get away from sports. What if everybody was a violin player? Where's the music if everybody plays only the violin? You can't have a symphony with all the beauty and the strength of the diversity without the combination of a lot of people doing a lot of different things. The first thing that I see when I look at the cemeteries is the tremendous strength of Texas and the United States. With all of this diversity, that people know their heritage. They don't confuse themselves and say, I'm a football player. They say, I'm a quarterback, or I'm a tackle, or I'm a defensive back. They know their background, therefore they know how they fit into the team. The second thing I see is the most controversial, so I will say it, and then I can duck, and I make sure this back door is open so I can run if I have to. Right now, there are two types of people, the Scotch, Irish, Germans leading the pack, who are pushing a movement in the United States that says English as the official language. In a certain way, I back that movement. But more important, there is a feeling and argument behind that that I fight with every fiber in my body, and that is English as the only language. I make a tremendous distinction between English as an official language and English as an only language. If we have an only language, we're all quarterbacks, or we're all violin players, and America is dead. The strength of America is that we're the only country in the world with the huge number of ethnic backgrounds that we have here. The Soviet Union comes close, but when you break that down, the Soviet Union is no longer a Soviet Union. And when they dissolved 2 years ago, the diversity, the ethnic diversity, almost all disappeared. What is strong about us is this ethnic background. Is it possible, this is the controversial part, is it possible to have a United States where English is not the only language? And I look now at this group. How can you possibly think that you need a language to have an ethnic identity? You are French. The food is French. The architecture is French. Your emotional ties are to France. 60% of the markers are in German. You don't need the language to have this love for France. You don't need to be an English-only speaker to have a love for America. So I went to my good friend Tom Brand after the discussion yesterday, and I said, Tom, your name is Brand. when you say just American, you're just as American as Baird. But I'd love to be able to talk five languages like Leon Petrofilov and have that strength. Okay.
Dr. Baird, we do thank you so much, but I'm in trouble. My maiden name is Brown, but I was saved by my mother, who was Gartheiser from Alphabet. We want to thank you so much for giving us food for thought and making us proud that we are Castro colonists, that we're Texans, and most importantly, just Americans. Does anyone have a question they'd like to ask Dr. Baird? Bertha, would you like to? Renee, we're going to put you to work. Oh, that's good. And again, Dr. Baird, thank you so much for being here today. We hope you'll come back and visit us again. Well, I'll wait for my secretary and my treasurer to get back up here. In your newsletter, we had copies of the minutes. Are there any corrections or additions to the minutes as printed? If not, I'd like a motion that we accept the minutes as printed. Charlie, thank you. Second? Oliver, second. Thank you. Treasurer's report.
This is a report for June the 1st through the 31st of August. We had a balance at that time, at the end of May, $4,038.51. We had income from dues, $55, sale of books, $688.75, miscellaneous $16, a redeposit of a lost check, $158.70, memorials $30, and bank interest $36.26 for a total of $984.71. We had expenses. The recent published new brochures, $127. Medina County Fair, $35. Quarterly meeting expenses, $128. Postage and paper supplies, $75. Book purchases and mailing expense was $273.50. That figure is a little bit misleading because we reissued that same check that was lost, and it in that 273 includes the $158 that we reissued the check for. Expenses then is $639.52, leaving a checking balance as of check stub number 685. $4,383.70. We got other assets in three interest-bearing accounts that are $34,391.24. And the total assets we possess as of the end of August was $38,774.94. Thank you all.
Good. Thank you, Joseph. I would like to report to you on our board meetings that we've had. We've had two this month. Sounds like we had a lot to discuss. Well, we did. We had our usual business, but I guess our biggest discussion had to do with our finances and the folklore book coming up. I'll ask Lucy to report on that later. And our membership, and again, our scholarship offer. We gave Joseph permission to buy a CD to get a higher rate of interest, and he did that. He bought a $16,000. He's taking the museum fund and adding $2,000 from our bank account. A checking account, giving us a good return on a two-year CD. We decided not to tie it up any longer than 2 years. Who knows? Maybe by that time the economy will go up again. Also, as of today, we have not received an application for the scholarship offer. So I'm pulling that off the table unless there is someone who today, before we end the meeting. If not, we will review that and perhaps do something else later. I'm sorry about that.